beyond those two categories, really it's more of, is, does it meet three criteria as to whether or not it's going to be patentable? So the three criteria is, are what's called novelty, obviousness, and abstraction. So novelty is basically, has anybody else invented this before? If somebody else has previously invented it, if you're not the first to invent it, you can't get a patent on it. So pretty simple thing. You invented it, nobody else did, that you meet that criteria. Somebody else previously invented it before you, you can't get a patent on it. Second thing is obviousness. And obviousness basically means, well, okay, not one person's invented this, but if you were to take two or more things that are out in the marketplace, all you're really doing is putting those together. You're not adding anything new. You're just combining a couple things. And again, if you're not really adding anything new, you're just combining something, it's not going to be patentable. If it's not obvious, you can combine things, but you have to add something to it. You have to make it unique, different, and something on your own. The last one is going to be what's called abstractions. And this one typically is more on the software side of things.
This is the Mindshift Podcast, where we share real stories, real strategies that will help you find real success. This is the place to hear from people just like you who have taken their ideas, goals, and dreams from a point of inspiration to realization, or when life knocked them down, from a point of breakdown to breakthrough. I'm your host, Daryl Evans. Let's get started with today's episode. Hey there, I'm Daryl Evans, and welcome to another episode of the Mindshift Podcast. If this is your first time here, or if you're a returning listener and have not done so yet, do me a favor, hit the subscribe or follow button right now, wherever you're listening to the show, so that you never miss an episode from our show. Also, after today's show, DM me or tag me on Instagram at Mr. Daryl Evans or at the Mindshift Podcast and let me know your biggest mindset shift from today's show. And also let me know where in the world you're listening from. I am really curious to learn more about my listeners all over the world. Lastly, if you're not a part of the free Mindshift community, head over to mindshiftcommunity.com to learn more. That's mindshiftcommunity.com. But don't do that now. It's time to shift your mind so you can shift your results. My guest today is Devin Miller. He has an interesting background of building several seven-figure and eight-figure startups along with founding a patent and trademark law firm. Check this out. He has 4 degrees, including electrical engineering, Chinese, an MBA, and a law degree. While working for a large law firm helping Fortune 100 clients like Amazon, Intel, Red Hat, and Ford with their intellectual property, he realized that there weren't many good intellectual property legal resources out there for startups and small businesses. As an entrepreneur himself, he wanted to help other small business owners learn about patents, trademarks, and copyrights so that they could build value into their businesses and protect their assets. If you've ever wondered about the difference between patents and trademarks and copyrights, oh my, did I really just say that? What they protect and when to use each one, you're in the right place. Quick disclaimer, Devin's discussion today on our show is for informational purposes only. His explanation should not be deemed legal advice for your business, but it is real good. Let's go. Devin, how you doing? Welcome to the Mindshift Podcast.
I'm doing awesome, busy as ever, and that's the way I like it. So appreciate you having me on.
I'm glad to have you here. Excited about today's topic. It's a topic that, from my work, is very interesting, and I've got some really interesting questions, and I think you're the man to answer them. It's going to be really exciting for those people that run startups, run businesses, have intellectual property, things in their mind, maybe they're not sure. So I think it's going to be real fun for them. But before we jump in, where are you joining us from today?
So I'm in Utah, just north of Salt Lake City in a small town that's called Morgan, Utah. But yeah, just north of Salt Lake City.
Awesome. Devin, tell our audience a little bit about yourself, your background, and we'll start there and jump into your backstory as an attorney.
All right. The shortest questions always have the most in-depth answers, so I'll keep it a bit shorter. So background is I've been married 13 years to my wife that we met in college. I'm a father of 4, ages 5 to 10, oldest is a son, and then 3 girls. And then a little bit on the educational and career background. So I've got 4 degrees, which my wife always says is 3 degrees too many. So I got an electrical engineering degree in Mandarin Chinese. an MBA, which is Master's of Business Administration, and then my law degree. So that's kind of what I did during school. I kind of have two passions. So I love startups and small businesses, done several myself. Some of them are now 7, 8, and one's now a 9-figure business, as well as love the law side. So I kind of always chase two passions of startups and small businesses, as well as doing intellectual property. And then as I started my own firm, did that a few years ago, kind of mesh all of those together and make it work well, at least from my end.
Wow, man. What an interesting set of a curriculum you went through. Tell me real quick, what was your initial thought when you started college? What was the first degree that you went after?
It was electrical engineering. So I really went in kind of thinking, oh, my dad did electrical engineering, kind of worked on things interesting. You know, the Chinese was more, I served a religious mission for my church in Taiwan. So it was more of, I picked up the language there and added that on. But I got towards the end of engineering and I said, you know, I like engineering, but I really don't want to be an engineer. So now how can I utilize that? And that's kind of where I got into the MBA, doing startups and understanding electronics and technology and also intellectual property to help a lot of startups and small businesses, particularly in the software and electronics area.
That's awesome. I mean, it's funny. I started down the path of electrical engineering and pivoted to business, but I didn't get the engineering degree. I pivoted in my junior year. And so I took a few steps back and pivoted to business. So very interesting similarity there. Let me ask you a question. So you started a number of businesses. Did you go into law first or did you start businesses first?
That sounds like it should be an easy question. I would say both, in the sense that, so I did when I graduated from undergraduate, got the Chinese electrical engineering, I was kind of trying to decide what I wanted to do when I grew up, or, you know, however you want to say it. So I ended up doing both the law degree at the same time I was doing the MBA degree. So I did a dual degree. To give you a context, so I was doing the law degree, doing the MBA degree. I was working 20 hours as a law clerk at a law firm. I'd had a 2-year-old. I just had a newborn. And then I decided to start my own business. And so I don't know how I fit all in, but it kept me plenty busy. So I started my own business while I was doing the law degree and the MBA degree, continued to do those, as well as I've had a full-time legal career that I pursued. So it really has kind of been both. And so I never wanted to choose, so I never chose. I just went both paths at the same time.
That's amazing, man. I mean, I don't know how you balanced all the time, but, you know, I think what it says, though, is it's just your tremendous determination to completion. I love the conversation around, you know, college degree. I know there's a big debate today about college degree. Do you need it? Blah, blah, blah. You know, but I think that what it says is when you go down this path of college, you're committed to a path and that path is yours to follow, because the college, typically they won't care if you don't show up. They'll keep your money. And if you fail, you fail. It's, you know, so you signed up for multiple opportunities. So you dualed MBA and law at the same time. What intrigued you about the world of patents and trademarks, that particular specific specialty?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought the law sounded interesting. It's probably, you know, you watch all the TV shows, which, just as an FYI to everybody, being a lawyer is not like it's on TV. That isn't like you get a lawsuit, you're in the court the next day, a week later, it's all resolved. And it never happens that way in real life. So I always thought law was interesting. But, you know, I always kind of thought it was interesting, the mixture of law and, you know, kind of intellectual property, which is a lot more to do with startups. You get to see a lot of cool gadgets. You get to see a lot of what people are working on. You get to help them protect it, build it as an asset in their company. So I always kind of thought that intermix of being able to leverage what I did in engineering and my background there, along with the law side, and kind of, you know, that intermix always kind of interests me and got me started down that route.
You mentioned starting several businesses, 7- and 8-figure and even a 9-figure business. I know that as I was doing some research on you, you started a business in the wearable, let me get it correct. What was it? The wearable
hydration monitoring.
Hydration. Tell us a little bit about that. That seemed really intriguing.
Yeah, that one's the one that went into a 9-figure business. A bit of background and context. It started when I was an MBA scholar, when I was doing the dual degree, and it started with a business competition. And I can't remember if it was an email or a flyer, and I always try and remember, and I never quite can, but it was one of those where I was looking and saying, you know, oh, you can get together multidisciplinary, you get engineers and marketers, lawyers and everybody together and kind of take all those talent sets and enter in a business competition. So I did that, went to the, you know, the introductory meeting, formed a group. We entered the first year. We entered in with an idea to make gym bags less smelly. Didn't really go anywhere. Came back the second year, and we're kind of brainstorming. We had some crazy ideas, self-packing boxes and other things. None of them ever really seemed like they'd make sense. And I was walking home, and at that point, and I was into marathon running, and I still run several marathons. And so it kind of was thinking, you know, my first marathon, I got dehydrated. I didn't drink as much. I tried to skip the hydration stations to make my time better, which was a terrible idea. And so with all that, I said, wouldn't it be cool if you can monitor your hydration so that you could see, you know, where your hydration level is. So when you're running, when you're doing athletics, that you're going to be able to preemptively, you know, not get dehydrated. So that was kind of the genesis. Took that idea, pitched to the group. They liked it. I went home over Christmas break with my dad, that's also an electrical engineer. We built up a prototype, mocked it up, started testing it, entered in the business competition, took second place, which I'm a little bit bittersweet about that because we should have taken first. But then we got to the end and we were all seniors at the time. We're all going to go different ways. So I said, hey, I'd like to just buy all you guys out. We're going to be in different states. It's not going to be very easy to work together. So I bought them all out, continued on with the business, and took on some investors, grew it to a point. And we were getting to a point where we're going to introduce in the marketplace, where it's going to be, you know, we need to do a second round of investors. We're going to get ready for manufacturing. And about that time, somebody that approached us or we got connected up with that was doing more in something in diabetes monitoring. And as we kind of talked it through, a lot of what we're doing with the measurements and the sensors and how we're doing it matched up well with the diabetes monitoring. And so we actually combined both the resources and the technology from what we're doing in the wearables with what they are doing in diabetes monitoring. And that's kind of pivoted to where the business is now, which is a lot to do more with wearables for non-invasive diabetes monitoring or glucose monitoring, and still has a lot of overtones of the hydration as well.
Wow. Very impressive. Very impressive. So what's your role in that company today? You're obviously a full-time attorney, but what's your role in the company? Are you just on the board or?
Yeah. So I have ownership in it. I still do a lot of engineering for it. I've done the intellectual property side with it. It's obviously a much bigger company than just me and myself. It's grown a lot bigger. And so I take kind of that role of doing some of the engineering technology development as well as on the intellectual property side.
And that's awesome. Well, you know what? Given the fact that that was a product that you built from scratch coming off the heels of a competition, pivoted into that, I think that leads right into some of the topics of today. You know, I think a lot of entrepreneurs listening, and I know for sure I've got these questions. Can you start off by telling us what is a patent? What is a trademark? And what is intellectual property? Can you draw a picture for us in each of those three lanes?
Sure. I'll start with intellectual property, because really what intellectual property is, it's just an umbrella term that has a few things underneath it. And that includes patents, trademarks, copyright. So usually when somebody says, hey, intellectual property, whether I'm intellectual property attorney or I need intellectual property, or what is your intellectual property, they're referring to that umbrella term, which can include one or all of those. Now, as far as kind of what a patent, trademark, copyright is, easiest way to kind of think about it is a patent is goes towards something that's an invention. If you create something, it has utility, functionality, it does something, that's going to be protected under a patent. Patent allows you to protect so that others can't make, manufacture, use, or otherwise utilize your technology without your permission. Trademarks go more towards the branding side of things. So if you're to think of the name of a company, name of a business, a logo, a catchphrase, name of a product, something along those natures, anything really to do with your branding, that falls under trademarks. And again, you're just trying to protect it so other people can copy or leverage your brand without your permission. Copyrights are going to be kind of the last part of it. Copyrights are more on the creative work. So if you're to think of a book, a movie, a sculpture, a painting, a podcast, a whatever, those kind of something on the creative nature, you're going to protect with copyright. So all three of those really fall under intellectual property as an umbrella, and they all kind of go to serve to protect different aspects of your business, depending on what your business is.
So in your world, with the product that you created, this wearable, just in my own knowledge, I know that there's different types of patents. Can you break down the different types of patents and actually tell us about the type of patent your product fell under?
Within patents, there's different things you refer to, but there's really just kind of two types of patents, and then I'll explain a little bit more on one of them. One of them is called a design patent. Design patent is really going more towards the aesthetic nature, the look and feel of it. So if you're to think of the Coca-Cola, you know, the old glass bottle, that's a design patent that they have around that that protects the look and feel of that curved shape. Same thing if you looked at the old iPhones, when they used to have the little rounded corners, they'd have their button at the bottom, that would have been for a design patent. On the other side, you got utility patents, and utility patents are going to go more towards what I said, the functionality that it does something. And they can protect quite a few different things. It can be software, it can be hardware, it can be, you know, mechanical in nature, it can be electronics, and really almost everything with a few exceptions is pretty well patentable, and you can go after and protect with patentable if it does something. Last thing, and then I'll answer the question as to what I did within the utility patent application, that something, the patent that is for something that has a functionality. There's a lot of times what you hear is called a provisional patent application or a non-provisional patent application. Provisional patent application is basically a one-year placeholder application. It's less expensive, less formal, but it gets you basically a placeholder in there that says, hey, here's my invention. I don't know if it's going to be valuable. I still got some development doing or saving up or doing a budget, but I'd like to get a date of invention so that anybody that comes along after this bumps into me. So provisional patent application, you file it, it gives you a year placeholder, gives you a year protection to decide whether or not you want to go for a full patent application. The non-provisional patent application, that's your full patent application. So you look at Shark Tank when you hear, you know, it's a Shark Tank on television, you hear, do you have a patent application on it? And they say, oh, I've got a provisional. Well, they're going to give you some weight on that, but they're going to say, well, that's just kind of a less formal one. It's a placeholder. It's not fully fleshed out. If you say, oh, I've got a patent application, you know, a non-provisional or full patent application, that's what you're going to go for. Full patent application is one where it has all the formalities. It has the drawings. It has all the sections. It describes your invention, and it goes towards that. Now, with all that as a setup, you asked me a little bit about what I did with the patent when I started the wearables company. That one was first patent I had drafted from start to finish on my own. I drafted that because we didn't have a ton of money for the business competition, nor did I personally, but I certainly had gone to law school, had the training, was doing that for other companies. So that's where we started. I did draft it from start to finish as a non-provisional full patent application and submitted that to the patent office. And since then, it's then been issued as a full patent application. But that's where it all started.
Appreciate the breakdown there. I also want to be sure, as we talk through this conversation, that those listening to this, Devin is a practicing attorney. Nothing that he says today is legal advice. Please seek out the proper counsel of an attorney, by which Devin is one. So we'll link up his information at the end of the show. That's really intriguing. A couple of thoughts that come to mind. I listen to it in my world because I work with a lot of entrepreneurs. Copyright, patent, trademark. And you said, so copyright is more of creative work. Trademark is sort of a brand mark or something of that nature that you don't want someone using your brand mark. And then the utility and or design side is where the patent comes in. You work with a lot of startups, and I think sometimes the word startup confuses people because someone can start a professional services business and be a startup. Someone can start a restaurant and be a startup. How do you define startup?
I would break it into two ways that I define it. One is it's a frame of mind, meaning I think you can have businesses that have been around for whatever that are still in the startup mind frame, and they're really, it's more of a ability to pivot, to adjust, you know, things that I'll give you what are not startups. A business that had planned five meetings, that have five more meetings, that then takes a month to implement, a committee that studies the viability of a product, and then 5 years later, you've done something. That doesn't, in my mind, isn't a startup because you have so many committees, so many ways to make a decision. On the other hand, you know, for me, a startup, one definition is you have an idea that week or that day or that, you know, you get started on it, you actually get it rolled out. I had an idea that we were working on some, you know, a very simple software application for on the IP side for our law firm. I went and approached our programmers. We had a mock-up. We had a functional prototype. We implemented and rolled it out in a week. And so it was that quick. So one time it's going to be that mindset of, hey, we're going to get things done quickly. We're going to get things done efficiently. We're not going to have a ton of overhead and insight. That's kind of one aspect of a startup. The other one is, I would say, is a bit of how early on the business is. And that's probably a bit more traditional. And usually it's you've only been out and going for 1 or 2 years, you may not have any revenue, or it's a pre-revenue, or you have a small amount of revenue. You're just kind of figuring out what you are. And then as you get that revenue coming in, as you get your product out in the marketplace, you've been around for 3 or 4 years, it seems like you kind of transition more from a startup to a small business. So that's kind of, you know, mindset is one as to how you approach a startup or small business. And then kind of the other is more the traditional of how long have you been in? Are you making any money? And kind of what that all means.
Are you getting stuff into the marketplace? Like, are you getting anything done other than just talking and writing stuff down, right? In your opinion, when is it a good idea for a startup to think about protecting their business with a patent or trademark or even copyrights? Do you even need to do anything formal to get a copyright? I'm kind of bundled the question there.
Patents, yes, you have to do something formal. Trademarks, yes. With some exceptions, trademark, you typically want to formalize them. There are some limited rights that you have with trademarks just by the being the first user, but I wouldn't recommend relying on those. Copyrights are kind of one of those things where they are a bit different in the sense that inherently by when you create the creative work, so you paint the painting, you record the podcast, you do the video, you do the television show, you write the book, whatever it is, when you create them, and what they call it is putting it in a tangible medium. So no longer in your head, you actually have to put it out so that you can show others what it is. Then you have some inherent rights with copyrights. And so you don't have to get a copyright. Now, I still recommend getting a copyright, but you do have those inherent rights of, hey, you're the creator, you have ownership of what you created. Two reasons typically why you'd get a copyright. What is hard sometimes, depending on what it is, when did you make that painting? When did you actually paint? Well, if you ever have to go and enforce your copyright, it can be difficult to define exactly when you made the painting. Yes, you can look back and I painted about 5 years ago. Okay, we'll prove it. And then it can get difficult. A lot of times you'll register a copyright, not because you don't have ownership to it, because it's a lot easier to define when you created it, such that somebody were to come along afterwards and copy it, you can show that you were the first to come up with it. The other thing that it oftentimes will do is by registering a copyright is it gives you ability to get increased damages. Meaning you can let, now people are on notice. You can actually say, hey, because we registered it, if we ever have to sue you, when we go to court and have to enforce it, you can get additional damages or additional compensation for them infringing your copyright. So you don't have to, because it's, you inherently have those rights, but there are a couple benefits to registering the copyright.
And so is it something that a business should be thinking about? At what point in the stage of someone creating something that they believe they want to either copyright or patent? And obviously we'll get into some types. I've got a couple other questions there, but should they be spending a lot of mental energy on this at the beginning? Obviously when a lot of startups are starting, they're light on cash, bootstrapping, putting things together. At what point does it make sense to protect these works?
Yeah. You know, I always say startups have more things to spend money on than money to spend, right? So there's always more things demanding what your money than you ever have to spend as a startup. And so I get that. My simple answer is early as you can, always the better, because that always avoids the most problems. Now, that's not always that helpful to a startup because everything needs to be done as early as possible. But, you know, I would back up the question just slightly. And the first thing I would do is figure out what kind of company you have or what kind of business you have. Figure out what the core of the business is, in the sense that if you are a product company, you're making the next best iPhone, the next best widget, whatever that might be, then you're going to at least know what we want to protect is going to be via a patent, because we're a product company. If on the other hand, you're going to be, you know, we don't have any great products, but we have a really good branding, we have really good marketing, SEO, you know, we have customer service, something that's associated with your brand, figure that out first. And that's what you're going to then at least know what you're going to want to focus on. Or copyrights. You're going to write the next best Harry Potter or Tom Clancy, or, you know, pick whatever book it is that you want to pick. And you're going to say, you know, that's where our value is. I would start, before you figure out how early to do, figure out the value of your business. Sometimes it overlaps. Sometimes you have a great product, you have a great brand, and so it's both. But figure out what the core of the business is. And then I would look and say, okay, when do we get to the point that we have invested enough that it's going to hurt if somebody were to come along and to copy that? So if you're just in the idea stage, you've tossed around a few ideas and you're going to say, hey, here's a really cool product we could make, haven't invested anything yet, haven't even figured out if it works or anything else, I probably wouldn't run off and get a patent yet. On the other hand, if you're starting to invest, you know, money, you're starting to invest R&D and time and effort and research and everything else, and you're getting some viability, at that point, then you should start considering to get some protection around it, because you've taken it to the beyond the point of an idea to the point you're actually investing in it, building something and, you know, getting some traction there. Same thing with a brand. If you're just starting out with an idea, hey, we're a local store or a mom and pop store, you know, we're not doing anything yet, we haven't really grown anything, you can probably hold off a bit until you start to say, okay, we want to franchise, we want to expand, we're going to go start selling online, we're going to soon do something of that nature. Then I'd start to protect it. Same thing. Copyrights are the easiest. If you wrote the book, you did the movie, you did the podcast, you did the painting, at that point, once you create it, get a copyright on it if it's going to be valuable. If you just like painting for fun and for a good time and for a hobby, don't worry about it. If you're doing a business around it, do it at the point that you've created it. The last thing, and then I've chatted for a bit on the trademark side, just circling back to that. The one thing that's hard for brands is a lot of times they start out as just a small brand. Hey, I'm going to just do a small niche product. Nobody else is going to copy me. I'm going to be a local mom and pop shop and I just want to service a local community or anything. You start out with that mindset, and then organically or naturally, as the business grows, it gets bigger and bigger to the point that you really should have protected your business a while ago. But because it was such a slow expansion, you never really thought about protecting the brand. And I'll have clients or potential clients, because I have to turn them away, they'll come in and say, oh, you know, we've been out in business for 4 or 5 years and we, you know, we'd like to get a trademark, and then say, you know, or even worse still, they'll come in and say, we've been in business for 4 or 5 years and now we notice another business is out there and they're copying our brand and they got a trademark. What do we do? And it's always that hard thing. It's either we have to have the uncomfortable conversation that there isn't a lot you can do, or it's going to be a lot more expensive, or it's going to be more difficult. And so on the branding side, particularly, before you start to grow, if you're really going to invest, even if you're going to be a more local or smaller niche, it's always worthwhile to protect your brand so that you can protect against the future.
I mean, great to share. It's funny, a story comes to mind. Local business here in our marketplace opens up a coffee shop, you know, boutique little coffee store, buying and fresh roasting and doing all the whole bit, and ended up getting a cease and desist from a company out of New Hampshire that had already had the company name, and she literally had to shut the door down. She could have changed the name, but there was just so much that had to do, and it just was a big whoop-de-doo. It was just, I felt so bad for her at that time. So, you know, I definitely appreciate the breakdowns here. For someone listening to this right now, and I think I want to talk about patents for a second, because again, Shark Tank's popular. We know the world of Silicon Valley and startups and software. Some of these things are instantly, like you jump out and they just grab you as to what is patentable and what is not. Can you share some examples of what can be patented? And maybe, and I know this could go a thousand directions, but what can be patented, what can't be? You've already talked about the types, you know, utility and design. But just a few high-level examples that maybe won't catch, they won't be very obvious to our listening audience.
Yeah, so I'll probably start opposite, because it's easier to ask what can't be patented, because most things can be. A couple things a patent office has just said aren't patentable. Don't try and patent a perpetual motion machine, because they're basically saying it defies the laws of physics. You can't make a perpetual motion machine. Don't even submit a patent. Now, if you can prove a perpetual motion machine, I am sure they'll still give you a patent on it.
What is a perpetual motion machine?
That basically means it creates its own energy, meaning it runs off of its own energy. You never have to input energy. So it basically is free energy that, you know, you get it going, you know, make a widget, make it start going, and it just creates free energy. It doesn't need anything, and it just makes its own free energy.
Okay.
Can't patent it. Defies the laws of physics. You can't make something from nothing. So they're saying, if you can prove it, try it. But until then, quit submitting patents on it. Same thing with the cure for cancer. Rare exception, they say cancer can't, now there can be treatments for cancer, but cancer as a whole can't be cured. We got way too many patents, people all just trying to patent cure for cancer. Again, you can't cure it unless, if you can cure it, prove it. Well, I'm sure they'll give you a patent, but otherwise they said that's not a category. Beyond those two categories, really it's more of, is, does it meet three criteria as to whether or not it's going to be patentable? So the three criteria are what's called novelty, obviousness, and abstraction. So novelty is basically, has anybody else invented this before? If somebody else has previously invented it, if you're not the first to invent it, you can't get a patent on it. So pretty simple thing. You invented it, nobody else did, that you meet that criteria. Somebody else previously invented it before you, you can't get a patent on it. Second thing is obviousness. And obviousness basically means, well, okay, not one person's invented this, but if you were to take two or more things that are out in the marketplace, all you're really doing is putting those together. You're not adding anything new. You're just combining a couple things. And again, if you're not really adding anything new, you're just combining something, it's not going to be patentable. If it's not obvious, you can combine things, but you have to add something to it. You have to make it unique, different, and something on your own. The last one is going to be what's called abstractions. And this one typically is more on the software side of things. When you, the abstraction basically means, are you trying to take something that people have previously done in their head, they've done on pen and paper, and all you're doing is sticking it on technology and trying to say it's new and innovative when really it's the same thing that's already out there. Easy example I usually give is 2 + 2 = 4. People have been doing that on pen and paper in their head before. If all you did was go stick it on a computer, said now 2 + 2 = 4, a computer's doing it instead of yourself, they're going to say, well, yeah, but that's not going to be patentable. It's abstract. It's something that people have already done in their head. So usually if you can meet novelty, nobody's previously invented it, it's not an obvious combination of something that's already out there, and you're not just trying to stick something that people have done in their head with pen and paper or on a computer. If you meet those three criteria, pretty much everything is patentable. The last one I give that I didn't circle back with is a business method. Business method is a method of doing business. About 10 years ago, those were patentable. There was a lot of bad patents that got through the patent office. You had some Supreme Court cases that really reeled that in. Very difficult. Not dead. It's possible, but it's incredibly difficult to get business method patents, a method of how you conduct your business. So don't get a perpetual motion machine. Don't do cancer. Unless you really have a great business method, probably avoid those. Meet the other three criteria and you can get a patent.
Wow. Very interesting breakdown. What comes to mind is someone listening to this and then they're thinking about a patent or any one of these other IP protection vehicles. Do any of these vehicles actually increase the valuation of the company just by having it?
Potentially, yes and no. And this gets into the same thing you gave the caveat. This is general business advice. It's not a specific advice for any given individual. Go talk with an attorney if you're going to get a specific advice. You know, generally, if they're valuable, meaning if you go get a patent and it's for something that's really dumb and stupid, you can still get a patent on it. It's not going to give any value to the business because it's a worthless patent. It doesn't protect anything that anybody would want to rip off anyway. On the other hand, you know, there's kind of, if you're not in that category, I always say there's kind of two reasons why you get a patent, and even trademarks and any of the three of intellectual property. And one is it protects your business. So it gives you a recourse. So if somebody comes along, they knock you off, they copy you, they try and ride your coattails, they try and do, or, you know, mimic what you're doing without having to do any of the work. It gives you that recourse. And that's kind of more of a defensive kind of an area. The other one is break down the words intellectual property. It really describes what it is. It's something that you created, that you did a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. It's intellectual. It's something that you thought of, and it's property. And that property is really where the value comes in the sense that what you get into a lot of times with businesses is you create a brand. Well, how do you capture a brand? How do you monetize it? How do you actually say, you know, this is worth a lot of value, especially somebody could go copy it. So, you know, you think of Coca-Cola, Pepsi, M&M's, Marvel, you know, any of those. They have a very expensive brand. You know, they put in a ton of time and effort. They defend it because it is an actual, you know, property that they own and that they can stop others from using as they build a brand. So go ask them if it's valuable. They'll obviously say yes. And if you want to go rip them off, you're going to get a nice cease and desist letter. Same thing on patents. And in that sense, it builds an asset into your company. So it's something that you can sell. So if you get into a merger or an acquisition or somebody wants to buy you out, they're going to say, well, what is proprietary? What's unique about you? And you're going to say, oh yeah, we make this wonderful widget. And they say, well, yeah, but that's easy to reverse engineer. I can go hire someone now that they can see what you're making. And you say, yeah, but I spent all this time and effort and blood, sweat, and tears and multiple years and nights and evenings and weekends. And they're going to say, well, that's great, but is it proprietary? And if not, then somebody else can knock it off. Well, the patent gives you that ability to have that as an asset. Say, no, we have something that's protected, it's proprietary. When you buy this, you buy the rights to make this. Nobody else can. You can license it, you can buy it, you can merge with us or any other thing. So it does create that asset or that actual property that is investable, that you can sell, you can buy, provides that property. So in that sense, it really provides both a defensive purpose as well as building an asset in your company that creates value.
Wow, man. Everyone listening to this right now, you're getting a masterclass from Devin Miller, man. This is amazing. You talked earlier about raising capital for one of your biggest projects. And I'm curious because I know a lot of people think, you know, today we're, you know, there's all these conversations about raising capital. We see all these, you know, big name companies, whether it's Silicon, Austin, any other place, raising investor funds. But what do typically investors look for in a startup when they're thinking about investing, whether it's venture or whether it's angel in the earlier stage? In your experience, and given that you've gone through it, what are they looking for?
Yeah, and I think every investor is different. I'll give you some general advice, but, you know, do your homework. The one thing I would do is if you're looking to raise money, before you even see do your homework on that individual, on the investment group, because there's a lot of different types of investment groups. They invest in different stages of companies and different types of products. They have different missions. They look for different criteria. And so do your homework on them so that you know specifically what they're looking for and if you're a good match or not. The other thing, and I'll answer your question, but I would also look and see whether or not you actually need investor dollars. There's always handcuffs that come along with investor dollars, and sometimes it absolutely makes sense. They can provide additional skills, resources, money that you need to develop. Other times, you can just build it your own, and yes, you may get antsy as a startup, and you might want to do it right now, but a lot of times, it makes more sense to slow down, bootstrap it, do it yourself, and to maintain that equity and that ownership such that as it grows and gets bigger, you don't have somebody else as a partner. With that said, there's also an area for investors, and a lot of times, they're going to want to look at It depends on how early stage you are. If you're going for venture capital, generally they're going to want to look and see, you got out and sold anything? How much, you know, is your client acquisition cost? How much is your annual recurring revenue? How much have you sold? How many customers, client base, and all of that? And they're going to look and see, okay, now if I go and invest this, am I basically just pouring gasoline on the fire to make it bigger? Because really what I'm doing is dumping additional cash and some resources, and they want a return in 3 to 5 years. And so they're going to say, if I invest this money, how's it going to take a business that's already cash flow positive, already making sales and already doing that, and make it bigger? So that's generally what a venture capitalist. Angel investors are usually, as you mentioned, earlier stage. They're going to say, okay, I'm going to take higher risk, probably higher reward if it takes off. And they're going to say, a lot of times when you go to angel investors, you don't necessarily, if you have sales, great. If you have, you know, viability, great. But a lot of times you're going to be a stage or two earlier than that. And they're going to, one, look at the team. They're going to look and say, okay, has anybody on the team ever done this before? If you've done a startup or small business before, it gives you credit. If it's been successful, even if it hasn't been successful, if you've at least been through this, it gives you some credibility as to you've done this before. Not a requirement. People go in there without that, but it is beneficial. So highlight that if you can. Another thing they're going to look at is they're going to look at the team. Okay, who do you have we can have confidence in that you actually have a reasonable shot of getting this? And that could be, hey, we've got a great CTO, great chief technology officer, or we've got a really good salesperson, or we've got somebody that's really good in branding or, you know, SEO or whatever it is, but we've got the team. And yes, you may be investing early stage. This is certainly a shot at the moon, but we've got a great team that you can actually trust in. So a lot of times, especially earlier on, they're going to be investing more in the team than they are in the idea. One thing typically I wouldn't necessarily do, don't go into the pitch and say, this is $100 billion market. And if we just get 1% of that 100 billion, we're all going to be rich. And they're going to say, yes, but you have to tell us, how are you going to get that 1%? Just telling us how big the market is doesn't work. So have a plan as to how you're going to go out and actually build a product, get the team, enter the marketplace, and have that strategy in place. So that's usually what they're looking for.
I love the point that you made about, you know, a lot of people run in and look for money, don't necessarily need it. Like, you're barking up the wrong tree. A lot of times, if you haven't been able to prove it with no money, from, you know, and you don't have to make thousands of sales necessarily, but if you can't produce revenue with little capital, little resources, what are you going to do with all the capital? And a lot of times you just throw it down the drain, and the investor is buying, especially angel at the angel level, they're definitely buying the team as well as the belief that you can pull off what you say you're going to pull off, because it's a 5 to 10 year run more than likely, and their money's going to be tied up. They could do other things with it. So it's a great point. As you've seen your company grow specifically, and this is outside of the law side of it, but as you've seen one of your companies grow, you've done obviously super successful with other companies, but what adds to the valuation of a business as it grows? Obviously revenue is big, but in your mind, from a, you know, you see these companies go from their 10 million a year in revenue, then they get an investor come in and all of a sudden they're worth $130 million. Their valuation comes in at $130 million. What do you think contributes to this conversation?
Sometimes it's a bubble or it's just crazy. Sometimes it's just, you get, Silicon Valley is notorious for, there's a bubble. They give crazy multiples. So, you know, I'll put those aside, that other than the bubble, or that just people are way over evaluating things. And, you know, sometimes you'll get, like, you'll see a Netflix or an Amazon and they're not even cash flow positive and yet they got a huge investment. It's possible, but I wouldn't bank on that. What you're typically looking for is when it does increase, is one is cash flow. One is, are you making recurring sales? And they're also going to look at and say, what is your customer base? How quickly are you acquiring customers? And so, and what is your cost to acquire customers? So let's say you have a low customer acquisition cost and you can just turn them in. That's going to say, hey, as we continue to grow, we can grow very quickly because, one, we're acquiring customers at a good rate. We're not spending an exorbitant amount to acquire customers and they're coming on. So that's one way that they can gauge and say, okay, we're going to look and see how quickly you're going to be able to scale and grow your business. And then they're going to do assign typically what's called a multiple. And a multiple is okay, your business is valued. If we were to just take what your business is worth today, it's going to be worth amount X, let's say 100,000. But we can say, okay, based on your industry, based on how quickly other companies have grown, how big industry is, what your customer acquisition cost is, what your price point is, all of those things are going to assign you a multiple. And that's where you sometimes will see that, hey, this business is only making $100,000 a year, but they're evaluated at $20 million. It's because they're, and that's probably an extreme example, but because they're assigning a multiple and saying, here's the potential, here's what we think it's going to be worth, what it could be worth, and basing on all those factors. So if you're to try and get your, you know, get those higher multiples, get a good customer base, get a good customer acquisition cost, get, you know, have a strategy. The other thing they're going to look at is the opportunity and other verticals that you haven't explored. So let's say you're in a very, you start out in a very small niche, a very small area, but you have a lot of ways that you can expand and grow this technology. So you can actually go into, you know, you may start out in the consumer goods, but hey, there's a great governmental route here, or contracts, or B2B, business to business, or other, all these other verticals that fit very well with your business that allow you to expand into others. Those will be other ways that they get a much higher valuation. So they're going to start to try and take all of that, bundle it together, and then determine what it's worth and assign a multiple on that, and then say, this is how much your company is worth.
Wow, thanks for the breakdown, man. There's a lot that goes into it. It's bigger. And like you said, I just read an article the other day. A company just took on $550 million in capital. And of course, that wasn't the whole story in the article, but the valuation is now $2 billion, right? So there's obviously a lot to the story that we don't hear in the article, but $550 million and now they're a $2 billion company. So, you know, and I use the product. So it's an exciting conversation to be a part of those kind of platforms when you're actually using it and watching it evolve. And I've actually had that happen many times. But yeah, thanks for breaking that down. I've got a question, man. So married 14 years, four kids under 9, under 10.
Or 10 and under.
10 and under. You run marathons. You have an active law practice. You have multiple businesses. I just have to ask, how on earth do you pull all this off?
First of all, my wife is awesome. My kids are awesome. So she's super supportive, and I had to give her a ton of kudos. You know, as far as being able to balance a lot of that, one is I built a, you know, whether I did a good job or just got lucky, but I have a good team that is built around. So I couldn't do it all by myself. And so I have a lot of good people that are here to support me, to help me to manage things, and I can be the one that gives a lot of direction, gives the insight, gives a, you know, here's where we're going, here's what we need to do. And then they are great at executing, great at building, great at making it happen. So that's one of the things that the team has been something that's supportive. The other thing that I always joke is, you know, anytime that somebody asks me whatever my hobbies are, I usually joke that my hobbies are startups, in the sense that if I have some free time, if I'm thinking about something, if I'm tinkering on it, it's usually something to do with a business. If I listen to a podcast, it's almost always either on business, marketing, or how other businesses have done it. If I read a book, it's the same thing. If I have free thoughts, I'm doing the same thing. I'm usually, if I'm in the yard doing work, I'll have headphones on listening. So I'm just a bit just love that. So it's just, I'm all in and just the passion. But then the other thing I would say is there is a balance I had to learn on the flip side of, if all you do is doing that, then you're going to neglect your family, you're going to neglect your kids, you're not going to get anything done, you're going to feel like a success of the business, but I failed in every other aspect of my life. And so what I always had to learn was, okay, I'm going to get up, I'm going to go to work, I'm going to work absolutely as hard as I can, I'm going to put out as many fires as I can, build as many things as I can. And then when the time comes to the end of the workday, I'm going to punch out and I'm going to go spend time with the family. I'm going to not be or so consumed with the business that I don't do anything else. And so I had to find that that's the way I approach is I'm going to work as hard as I can while I'm at work. And then I'm going to take off and not be at work when I want to be tuned in with the family. So that's kind of on that. Beyond that, just love it and excited about it. And I think if you have the passion and the drive, it just makes it fun and exciting, allows you to do a lot more.
Yeah, I can't agree with you more, man. The passion, you got to be all in. If you're going to do something, you got to be all in. And especially when you're doing multiple things. And, you know, I love the idea that, hey, when the day is over, I'm shutting it off. I'm checking in with the family and not getting so stretched out to where you're sacrificing relationships in pursuit of passions and dreams. And sometimes we as entrepreneurs can do that and neglect those that love us and mean the most to us after the chase or the big idea, right?
Yep.
I got to ask you a couple quick questions as we get ready to wrap up. That is, so how do you handle pressure? When pressure mounts, what does Devin do?
Sometimes Devin curls in a ball and cries. No, not very often, although there's always those times where you just want to give up. You know, I think that I'll go back to probably some of the other end. Having somebody that is a support system, and my wife has a great job, and somebody that, you know, half the time she doesn't even probably doesn't pay attention or doesn't necessarily even know what I'm venting about or rambling about or anything else, but she's there, she listens, she supports, she tries, you know, wherever she can to do it. So one thing is just to have a good support system. And then it's just with the realization that there are going to be times where it's going to suck. It's not going to be fun. And that's kind of where you get into, you see the movies, you read the books, and it's all just perfect and everything works out. It's not that way when you're really in a business. And I think you just have to come into it with the understanding of sometimes things aren't going to, some weeks I feel like an absolute success. Other weeks I feel like an absolute failure. And having that understanding of you're going to have both times, and you just have to have the determination that when I'm in the failure mode, I'm going to hit back to the success mode. And I don't know that there's any other way to approach it. Get a good support system in, have that realization that you're going to hit both, and then just have a good time doing it. I think if you have the passion, if you have the something that you do to love, and I always hate the thing, just do what you love, because if passion, you know, the money will follow. Well, I think if all you do is what you love and there's no business for it, then nobody wants to buy it. You can have as much passion in the world, it's not going to work. But find something that is you're passionate about that also has a business behind it, and that carries you through a lot of the hard times.
I love it. If it don't make any money, just You mentioned a key point that I want to kind of circle back to, and that is the teams and the support system. So obviously there's an in-home support system. There's the support systems around your businesses. I take you as an, I'm not sure if you're familiar with EOS, not that that's a process that I follow heavily, but they have a very clear distinction between a visionary and an integrator. Sounds to me like you're very much the visionary and you've got the integration teams built around you. I mean, you've said that several times. For those listening who've yet to build out their teams, it's something I really believe in as part of my mind shift business triangle. It seems like you really harnessed in your superstar DNA, that definite natural ability in terms of how you run your businesses. And then you've really looked at building teams. What's one piece of advice you could give the listening audience about team building?
As weird as it sounds, I would slow down on the team building in the sense that what usually happens with a startup or small business is you start out with this yourself or maybe one other co-founder and you get going. And if you get any sort of traction, then get to a pinch where you don't have enough time to do everything. So you go, we want to run out and hire someone as quickly as you can. And then most of the time, that's a bad hire in the sense that you don't slow down. You overlook the red flags. You don't even take enough time to know that there are red flags. And then you start to hire people just because you need a warm body. And then you also typically make the mistaken assumption that everybody's going to work as hard as you are. Everybody's going to be as passionate as you are. Most of the time when you bring on employees, they don't have that same passion and that same vision. Or what I found best thing to do with team building is slow it down. I usually do two or three rounds of interviews at least when I'm hiring anybody on, and that can be for any position. I'm not going to do it off of one interview. I'm not going to do it off a resume. I'll usually go through about three rounds because I want to get to know them in different contexts, see if their answers match up, have other people in the interview, talk with them about other things. And that's how you, I think, to build the best team is to slow down the process, walk it through, look for the red flags. And I always see if there's a red flag, if I don't feel comfortable, even if they're great on paper, even if they say the right things, if I don't feel comfortable about it, I'm just not going to hire them because there's something that's telling me that I don't want them and it's not going to fit well. And so that's the other thing is, you know, a lot of times you can find people that's great on paper, you know, they have all the right criteria and yet they just don't feel like they're going to mesh well. And even if they do have all those skills, you're going to find that it will pull your company in a different direction that you don't want to go. You're always going to be butting head. They're going to be wanting to do something different. It's going to wreck the culture that you've worked so hard to build in your business. So slow down, take your time. And then that allows you to find the people that will better fit with the culture.
I love that advice. Slow down, interview multiple times so you can make sure that it's a good fit. And just be focused on the, I always like to say, and I think you were saying it is, be clear about what it is you need that person to do. Fog a mirror. Warm body isn't the right hiring strategy.
Right? It happens a lot more than it, you know, we laugh at it. It happens a lot. Completely agree.
Believe me, man, 25 years of me hiring people, believe me, I've made plenty of those mistakes where the work is overwhelming. It's you and one person or you by yourself as a solopreneur. And you just like, I got too much stuff to do, right? But one of the things I always tell people is like the key to hiring great people is to really have a clear understanding of the right job description. And a lot of times, to your point of slowing down, you don't know what the right job description is because you've got 8 million things to do and you haven't, you hire the one person and you want them to do 6,000 of the 8,000, right? That's not going to work. Devin, you are available for consulting, obviously, for hire. You've got a gift opportunity for the person who's listening to this right now who maybe has some questions around IPs, around patents, around trademarks, those kind of things. How can people connect with you if they want to connect with you? And here's the other side of it. You're not just an attorney. You're not just speaking about law. You're an entrepreneur. You've built several businesses. You know all sides of this, which I really respect.
Yeah. And I always, you know, toot my own horn just for a second. That's the one thing that I feel like oftentimes missing with legal advice is you'll get attorneys that are great at being attorneys. They don't have any idea of the business overlay, how it impacts the business, whether it makes sense to invest, what the return on investment is. Whether you go with us or anybody, always look for that because they give you, I think, much better advice. If they want to reach out to me, they want to find out more, I'll give you a couple ways. If they want to reach out to me, do a one-on-one strategy consultation, kind of sit down, chat about your business, what you might need. I'll tell you whether or not you need something. And if you don't need it, I'll tell you that. Or a lot of times it's you need it, but I would wait 3 months, 6 months, any of the above. Then go to strategymeeting.com, all one word. Grab some time with me. That links right to my calendar. And so they can just grab some time and we can sit down. A lot of times it's via Zoom because I work with clients across all the US. But if they want to come to the office, they're welcome to as well. But strategymeeting.com is a great place to connect. If they just want to find out more about the firm, about myself, about our prices, about our structure, how we do anything, just generally about the law firm. And we have a ton of resources to learn a lot about it. Go to lawwithmiller.com. So lawwithmiller, all one word.com. And that's a great resource to kind of start out, figure things out, getting. So strategymeeting.com if you want to reach out to me directly, lawwithmiller.com if they want to find out more.
Awesome. Appreciate you sharing that, Devin. And thank you for taking some time to stop by the Mindshift podcast and share just a wealth of information around this topic. It's been a topic on my mind as not only a business owner of, you know, 20 plus years, but also jumping into the world of media now, which is a whole new genre for me. So it's been very helpful for me as well. Hopefully listeners have gotten something out of that. Last question I always ask my guests, and that is, if for whatever reason you weren't able to be here on this beautiful planet that we call home tomorrow morning, what would you want everyone to know you for?
Well, I'd want them to know as a good husband and father. And if that was the only thing I could leave on this earth was, hey, I was a good husband to my wife, I was a good father to my kids. I don't think anything else really matters in the long run. You can build the best business in the world. You can be the most success, have the most income. And if you fail in those two areas, I think you're a failure in life. Vice versa, you don't have to have the most successful startup or make the most money. If you can be a good husband and father, that's what matters. So that's what I'd want to be known for.
Devin Miller, thank you for being on the Mindshift podcast.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Hey, my friend, thanks again for listening to today's episode of the Mindshift podcast. Listen, let's not have the conversation end here. Connect with me on social at Mr. Darrell Evans on almost all the platforms, with the exception of Facebook. My Facebook fan page is at Darrell Evans Fan. Until next week, remember, you're just one shift away from the breakthrough you're looking for.